You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run. Stage 13. Today we are in Los Machucos.
Where are we, Daniel?
It's a good question. Where were you about half an hour ago? You weren't here, were you?
No. I was barreling back towards Bilbao, where we started this morning, before coming to Cantabria. We're in Cantabria now. Oh, goodness me, what was that?
A firework. A firework, and it's still light.
That's weird, isn't it?
Anyone listening wants to get the best use of their fireworks. Generally, best lit at night time.
Mm. Indeed.
We're in Cantabria.
I had some... Oh, my God. I think we're under attack here. I had some Cantabrian stew for lunch.
Cocido Montañés.
Yeah, followed
by... There's some on the menu. I can see the menu for this evening over there, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
And so there was calamari with black squid sauce.
So tell me about the stew. Was there white beans?
White beans, yeah.
Some pork. With some kind of pork.
Some fatty pork.
And some cabbage. Something like cabbage.
Maybe. It was nice. It was nice. And the two courses for €11, Daniel. €11. Anyway, I had a nice lunch because I didn't quite make it up to the top of Los Machucos. You were there. What was it like up there?
Nice. if we're going to go down, nice. If we're going to apply your, you know...
Yeah, it's not a wine,
lexical
Daniel.
Standards.
Let's have a bit more description.
It was an exciting stage, wasn't it? The Pog and Rog show.
Pog and Rog show.
I've confused myself with all this Pog and Rog nonsense because, you know, I did in the mix zone of the Vuelta a España today.
Oh, no. Is this worse than Bardet and Barguil?
I said, Primoz, you said you were tired this morning and didn't look like it. And I was talking to Tadej Pogacar.
Oh, my goodness me.
Hopefully that's been cut. From the ITV highlights, the first word anyway.
Hopefully it hasn't. Okay, well, what happened today? I mean, we started in Basque Country in Bilbao. Very, very climby stage today, wasn't it? 7 classified climbs, 4 third category climbs among them, 2 second cat climbs, and then, Los Machucos in a category of its own, really. It's a real monster of a climb. And very, very steep in places, so really... all the GC action happened on that final climb to the finish. But there was a big break. It took a while to get away. And it was a big old group, 29 riders. Finally, a Team Ineos rider in there, or a couple. David de la Cruz and Wout Poels. Geoffrey Bouchard from AG2R. We've seen him on the attack before. He was there. Sergio Henao, also a regular attacker. Thomas de Gendt, of course. Louis Menkes was there. Remember, Louis Menkes, I mean... almost vanished, but he was up there in the break today, they got a pretty big lead, and it looked for a lot of the stages as if they were going to stay away and one of them win the stage. But Astana really, I mean, I think Jumbo Visma were setting quite a fierce pace defending Roglic's red jersey, but on the approach to the climb, Astana really did take it on, and they pretty much halved the gap. It went from about 7 minutes to 3 minutes in no time at all. And on the climb itself, well, I have to defer to you here, Daniel, because for complicated reasons, I wasn't able to watch a lot of the climb. I did see Pierre Latour up the road, looking to me as if he was going to win the stage. But he was overhauled by the Slovenian... What would we call them? Slovenian
band.
Speedsters. Yeah.
But why didn't you explain this to me? I'm intrigued by this. What? So you obviously saw something, but not. What were you watching? Were you sort of seeing
on another channel.
Morse code, or what?
Watching a preview for the Tour of Britain. No, I was actually. I got held up in Bilbao, leaving Bilbao, so I didn't get there before 2 o'clock. That was a cut off for getting up to the top of the climb. Just missed that. And hence a nice lunch. But I got the folding bike out instead. So I was at the bottom of the evacuation road, got the folding bike out, the Austin Cycles Atto carbon bike.
I didn't ask how you spent your afternoon.
With
I
gears.
Asked how you saw this
I
bike
rode
race.
Up the evacuation road, which is basically the other side of Los Machucos, with my phone on my handlebars watching on Eurosport the stage. It became apparent at some point that I wasn't going to make it to the very top to see the finish, in time for the finish. I made it about 6 kilometres up there, I had to turn around. And obviously when I turned around, I couldn't, coming down this very steep hill, I couldn't hold the phone on the handlebars safely. So the phone had to go in the pocket. I dashed to the buses, did a few interviews there when the riders came down. But I missed a few crucial moments, so I need you to fill in a few gaps for me. What happened on the climb? When I watched it again, Roglic and... Rog and Pog were off the front.
Yes.
Incidentally, on that evacuation road, about halfway down, like 3-4 kilometres from anything, in the middle of nowhere, was the Roglic camper van, all branded up Roglic, with his wife and baby are staying in that.
Yeah, the camper van has been it's been a feature, hasn't it? It's part of the furniture of the Vuelta now. There aren't many camper vans on the Vuelta, but it's very patriotically bedecked.
But understated, camper van, isn't it? Understated. There was a but it's got his name on it and stuff. But it was in the middle of nowhere. I don't know why it was there. Presumably to intercept
him. There was
him.
Some beef because I actually overheard Rog's partner. I'm not sure whether they're married or not.
I think
she'd had some issues today, much like yourself, Rich. She'd had problems with the Vuelta organization and she couldn't park the camper van where she wanted to park, or it was all very contentious.
So is she driving it around?
There's someone else. There is someone else, I think, who might be driving her around. And also Rog's Italian manager, Swiss Italian manager, so Italian speaking Swiss manager, Mattia Galli, is also he's part of that kind of entourage, and he's sort of with them some days as well, I've noticed.
I've seen him around. In the end, it was a Slovenian duo.
You asked me what happened on the climb.
Didn't get around to that, did we? In particular, what happened, because obviously Astana were setting up for Lopez, but that backfired a little. At what point did the Pog and Rog get away?
Quite close to the top.
Yellow card for crisps, I think, before anybody tells us.
Before that, Rich, the first significant attack had come from the Nairo Man, quite low down on Los Machucos, and as we often see on these extremely steep climbs, it's very difficult to get away. And he went off the front, and there was clear daylight between him and the rest of the favourites, but he didn't build a very big advantage. It was 3 or 4 seconds, I would guess. And at that point, it looked very much as though, against the odds, that the break was going to survive, because certainly at the bottom of the climb, when the advantage had fallen to sort of under, Latour's advantage had fallen to just over a minute, it looked as though he was doomed. But then it didn't really move the gap for quite a while, and Nairo Man attacked, and he was sort of brought back. Superman wasn't really capitalising on all the work that his team had done, but he looked as though he was nestled fairly safely in the group of leaders. And then Quintana was caught. He attacked out of the back this time. One of them ones. And then Pog made his move on one of the harder sections towards, I would say, about three quarters of the way up the climb. And Pog was the only... You can see why I get confused. And Rog was the only man who could go with him.
It's surprising, isn't it? I think we let's talk about that in a moment. Let's finish with the tail of the tap. I'll give you the results. So the winner was Tadej Pogacar. Daniel, red card. No, I can't give you a red card. I need you. Just crisp eating. There'll be complaints. Primož Roglič was second. Pierre Latour held on for third. Alejandro Valverde came in fourth with Quintana. They were 27 seconds down. Bad day for Miguel Ángel López, a minute and 1 second down in the end. looking back down the classification, a result that stood out for us was James Knox in 13th. Very good ride for him. He's still climbing up. Our diarist, of course, and we'll hear from him later in the episode. So overall now, Roglic is obviously still in the red jersey. Valverde now 2:25 down. Pogacar up to third overall at 3:01. Second, Lopez down to fourth at 3:18. And Quintana down to fifth at 3:33. And decent ride today by Nicolas Hedé, who had the red jersey for one day, of course, and he is still seventh overall. Carl Fredrik Hagen slipped down a couple places to eighth.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run.
Thanks very much to Rafa, our title sponsor. I've been saying for a few days I was going to watch the Leadville film from the EF Gone Racing selection. I watched that last night, actually. Alex Howes, Lachlan Morton and Taylor Finney, although Taylor Finney didn't actually end up riding it because he did his back in. But it's really interesting, and it's part of, obviously, EF Education First alternative calendar, which, if nothing else, is allowing us to get to know Lachlan Morton a little bit better and understand how he works, how he operates, how he ticks, and his personality. And I found it really entertaining and really interesting, and it's fascinating to see those guys take on riders who, frankly, I've never heard of, and it's sort of highlighting how good they are at what they do as well. So recommended. You'll find that at rafa.cc or on YouTube, Rafa channel there. You can watch the latest EF Gone Racing film, and there's a lot of them there to watch, obviously. Quite a catalogue. So today, Daniel, I mean, I never quite made it all the way to the top. Quite enjoyed my ride up, though. It was quite nice, quite enjoyable, yeah.
In this part of Cantabria, I always notice that as soon as you transition from the Basque Country to Cantabria, the vegetation changes, and there's the Basque Country is very much sort of synonymous with these steep sloped hills and pine forests, and in Cantabria everything opens out and you get this incredibly vibrant green. I'm kind of surprised that that isn't a thing, Cantabrian green. It's a shade of green unlike anything
maybe it could
you
be
see
a,
anywhere else. It's almost
posh,
luminous, isn't
posh
it?
Posh paint company, Farrow and Ball or something. Could be a Cantabrian green could be one of their
very much
their
so,
colours.
It all becomes very pastoral, doesn't it? You start to see the cows and these sort of wide open landscapes and the sort of rocky outcrops as well.
It looked stunning today, and yeah, very very remote places. I mean the Roglic. I have to now every time I say his name, I'm thinking about whether I've got it right or not. But the camper van was in the middle of nowhere, but there was the odd kind of farm or, you know, home. And then there was, you know, it was very kind of, you felt like you were transported back in time a little bit. It's very, because the Basque Country is pretty wealthy. You know, I think that Cantabria, Galicia, they're not so prosperous. And there's a certain sort of rustic quality to this part, Galicia even more so. Before we finish, though, mentioning the Basque Country, we left there this morning, of course, from Bilbao. Our latest episode of Kilometre Zero is on the Basque Country and covers Bilbao and my night out in the Pinchos last night. But Daniel,
your night out on the
my night on the Pinchos, yeah. And we went out for dinner with Enrico Garati, who publishes cycling books in Spain, and he gave me a book this morning. Have you ever heard of Gustave Delure?
Yeah, I have.
So he published a book last year about him. He's the first ever winner of the Vuelta. He won the first two, a Belgian, incredibly. And a fascinating story. The book is called De la Vuelta a la Luna, from the Vuelta to the Moon, because he went on to work for the Apollo project in the US in later years. Some great pictures in there from the race. But he was a Belgian with some kind of American. He married, I think his parents were American. I'm sort of remembering scraps of my conversation with Enrico this morning. And his second wife, his widow, is still alive, and he met her in America. So really, I'm going to look a bit more into him, because I must say I'm not familiar with his story. But he, Eneco published a book about him last year, which it's in Spanish. If you can read Spanish, then check it out. We'll put a link up on Twitter or something. But we left the Basque Country behind, and here we are. A stage where it was one of those where I think we imagined that if Roglic had a weak spot, it might be on the super steep climbs. So it's surprising in a way that Roglic and Pogacar, two of the less kind of lightweight riders in the top 5-6 on GC. I mean, they're quite powerful riders rather than, you know, the kind of featherweight climbers a la Lopez and Quintana. Surprising, those were the two that really capitalized today, I think.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think what today also revealed is that we've seen pretty much all we're going to get from Valverde, Quintana and Superman at the moment anyway. I don't think they've got what it takes in their armoury to really threaten Roglic in his current state, in his current form. Which is not to say he's invulnerable. I think he could definitely weaken in the final week. I spoke to Miguel Indurain, that's a big name drop, a couple of days ago, and he talked about how, you know, at this stage in the season, it doesn't matter what your race program has been, everyone's getting mentally tired, physically tired, and that's a real feature of the last week of the Vuelta. Spoken like a man who never won the Vuelta. But so I think, you know, it's far from over. Jumbo-Visma are looking pretty good. You know, there is a school of thought that Quintana and Movistar become more dangerous now because, and as well, Astana, because I felt that they were protecting their position until now. They knew that there was a lot of climbing to come, and they were riding relatively conservatively. I think now they've probably realised as well that it's going to take something quite special, quite radical to unseat Roglic, and that's what they might ultimately go after, particularly Movistar, you have to think, with two riders still in contention, Valverde and Quintana.
It was quite surprising today that in that big group, there wasn't a lot of Astana or Movistar firepower. You know, that's the tactic they've deployed in the past. They've put some of their big guns up the road. They didn't do that today. They tried something quite different. Well, what do you think the reason for that was?
I think probably the fact that a teammate on the final climb was next to useless. It's also a pretty short effort. I don't know how long the climb took, but I guess 20-25 minutes.
It took me longer than that on the old folder.
So, you know, I think the leaders had all reconciled themselves to the fact that they were going to have to look after themselves on that climb. Astana did make the race very hard, and we saw that from the rate at which the gap to the break was coming down, but as we said earlier, it was a bit of an own goal because Superman obviously wasn't on a particularly good day. It'd be interesting to know. I mean, I didn't speak to any of them afterwards, but it'd be interesting to know what messages he was sending back to the DSs, back to them, back to his teammates, whether it was all premeditated. And as it turned out, he just wasn't on a very good day. But, you know, there have been question marks before or questions raised about his sort of his authority as a leader and his ability to, particularly with such an experienced team, guys like Cataldo, Luis Leon Sanchez, these Aguirre brothers. I mean, it must be quite hard for a 25-year-old to give orders, give instructions to those guys. And, you know, maybe he wasn't feeling great but didn't communicate it well enough. And they stuck fairly, you know, religiously to a plan that had been pre-hatched.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of race radio at the Tour de France, reminding us to tell you that this episode of our Vuelta a España coverage is sponsored by The Economist. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects, from world politics and business to science, technology, the arts, the environment and sport. And most crucially, The Economist sifts through the noise, focusing on the essential information that tells the real story in a time when facts matter more than ever. Richard, what have you read in The Economist this week?
Well, Lionel, story headline, Very Buried. And this concerns a football club, Bury, which has been expelled from the Football League. Sorry for the football reference, but I thought it was quite interesting because we talk a lot about the business model in cycling, and it's quite interesting to compare it to the most sort of cash-rich sport on the planet, perhaps, football. The Economist says that strange people are common in football, meaning football club owners. This is a quote from Greg Dyke, the former chairman of the Football Association, who said that over the years, some quite strange people have taken over and run football clubs. And The Economist says this is mainly because, as a rule, buying a club is a bad idea if you plan on making money. In the Championship, the second tier of English football, wages swallow 106% of turnover, according to Deloitte. It's a little better in League One, the third tier, where wages make up 94% of turnover. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, in 2017, the last year accounts are publicly available, Bury reported a loss of £2.8 million from revenues of £4.7 million. I mean, it is a basket case as a business. I mean, a lot of football clubs are. And it's just interesting because, again, making that comparison with cycling, where we talk about the business model in cycling, one thing you can say about cycling teams is they're not saddled with huge amounts of debt.
No, but neither do they have any assets. They don't have a stadium where they do their cycling, of course. But the one thing that's interesting that I keep meaning to sort of dig into a bit is that you talk about the percentage of turnover being spent on salaries. And I wonder if a cycling team attracted a sponsor and said, well, we're only going to spend 70% of the money you give us on this year's team because we're going to save the rest of it for as a bit of a nest egg for the future when you basically pull out. I wonder how that would go down. And I think that's a very delicate dance that cycling teams particularly...
Well, I don't think cycling teams have the same challenge because they can the money they have come in, they can just spend it because they don't have overheads as such.
No.
They have a budget for running a team over a year and that's it.
But they have to deliver a return on the sponsorship money that they have. And so if they only spent 70% of the money that a sponsor was paying them, would the sponsor, if the results didn't go well, would the sponsor turn around and say, well, perhaps if you spent everything we'd given you this year, we'd have had a better return on our investment? I mean, it's a fascinating subject. And certainly the economics of sport feature quite regularly in The Economist magazine. And they always have a much more kind of a much sharper way of looking at it than I do. And I always learn something from it.
I also love the distance they have. They tell you the story as if that's the first time you've read it. And even a story like that, which I've been kind of following vaguely, it's nice to see it all set out there.
They strip out the emotion, really, don't they? And they focus on the facts and they focus on the cold, hard logic of the story. And they do that across a range of subjects, not just things that concern pounds and pence. If you'd like to have a free copy of The Economist sent to your door, just text the word cycling to 78070. That's the word cycling, and text it to 78070. The Economist is a smart guide to the forces changing your world.
Well, Daniel, you mentioned that Jumbo-Visma were very strong today. It's a different Jumbo-Visma team to the one that they had at the Giro, isn't it? Very, very much stronger. Robert Hesink is ever reliable. Sepp Kuss has been fantastic. Nielsen Paulus, very good as well. I mean, he was actually 21st on the stage. George Bennett, 23rd. So those guys both doing pretty well and both up there. Is that more crisps, Daniel? You can't... I spoke to Nielsen Paulus back down at the buses after the stage. Here's what he had to say. Well, I guess that probably couldn't have gone much better, could it?
No, I think it was perfect. I think we were at the bottom of Los Matruchos with five guys still, so I think it was exactly how we planned it, and it was couldn't have gone better for Primoz. Yeah.
And yourself personally, how did you find the climb?
Yeah, pretty good. I think at the bottom I was just assuming that the pace was going to be a little too high for me on the first pitch, so I started to just let it go a little bit and not overdo it. But as soon as I saw the guys not really getting away from me too much, I just thought that if I can just stay as close as possible for as long as possible to Primoz, then that's best case scenario. So yeah, I actually ended up finding a really nice rhythm on the climb and felt pretty good. And then about 2K to go, the director came by and just told me that Primoz was was he was in the clear, and he was running away from all the GC riders, so he's putting a lot of time into him, and he said that he was safe, so he could just take it a little bit easier in the last 2K, and then just tried to conserve a bit more towards the end. But up until then, I was in a really nice rhythm.
And Astana really committed to it. It looked like they had something up their sleeve today. Was that a cause of concern, just see how many riders they had and just how much they were committing to it?
We assumed that they were going to do something like this. That's kind of their one card, is to really try to do something with Lopez on the steep climbs. But I think Primo's just countered it pretty hard, which was really impressive. And I think he really put his stamp on the race and really showed that, you know, he's not just the best time trialist, but he's the best rider here. So, it's been a amazing run so far. So I hope we can keep it up.
So that was Nielsen Paulus, and he's riding his first Grand Tour, riding extremely well. Sepp Kuss is riding a lot better here than he did at the Giro. They've got Hessink, as I mentioned, Bennett. It's a really sort of complete team. Tony Martin is doing a power of work as well. He's been outstanding for them. And, at the moment, Roglic is in such a strong position. They're on course to have finished on the podium at each of the three Grand Tours, which is a pretty decent return, isn't it?
It is, Rich. I spoke to their team manager, team principal, team
Richard Plug?
Ayatollah.
Is he here?
Yeah, Richard Plugger this morning. And I asked him actually about how they're going to manage things next year with Tom Dumoulin coming on board as well, and Kruijswijk and Roglic.
That's the funny thing. They're missing Kruijswijk, and they're not missing him.
No. And you notice that more, don't you, with these eight-man teams. As soon as you take, obviously, losing someone like Kruijswijk for a nine-man team would be bad enough. But you lose someone like that from an eight-man team, and you automatically think the team is going to be almost debilitated, and that's not been the case thus far. But I asked Richard Plugger what he was thinking about next year, and he sort of confirmed what we would all suspect, that they're going to wait until the route to the Grand Tours are announced before they make any big decisions. But one thing that struck me was that he mentioned having had conversations with Roglic, Kruijswijk and George Bennett before, sort of, well, kind of as a preliminary measure before going ahead with the Dumoulin move, or he sort of squared it with all of those guys, or at least wanted to talk it through with those guys. Because I suppose Bennett would be the one whose status is a little bit uncertain, in the sense that, he's good enough to probably harbour some personal ambitions of maybe one day having another go at the Giro or the Vuelta, if not as the main leader, certainly as a secondary leader. And what he's turning into is what we've seen a lot of very good, very highly touted riders at Team Sky and Ineos turn into, isn't it? He's almost too good for his status as a sort of first lieutenant.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Hi, I'm Terry Gegenhart, and I ride for Team Ineos. My favourite Science in Sport product is something that we in the team have affectionately called Rocket Fuel. However, if you're searching for it on the website, it'll be under the title Beta Fuel.
Thank you to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast, and 25% off to you, the listeners. If you fancy stocking up on Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. We're going to hear the audio diaries in a moment. I thought, given James Knox's performance today and Philippe Gilbert's victory yesterday, that I would ask Wilfred Peters, the sports director there, for his verdict on both performances, I suppose. So, first of all, I asked Peters what he made so far of James Knox's performance.
Well, I'm very proud about him. He was 13 in classification, maybe, and in the race today. He's still a long time with the favourites. I think he was 7 or 8 from when the guys can start with a big bunch. And I improve every day, and maybe in the last week we can do something.
Is this kind of in line with what you expected from him?
Yeah, we hope in the beginning top 15. Okay, he's still 18 now. Let's wait until the last week. you feel better and better with long climbs. They're very steep and not like it, but today we make a good job.
And yesterday was a good day for you as well, obviously.
Yeah, sure, we tried to have a stage win, and I think what we did in the first week, we not won the team time trial. We lost with 5 seconds, but then Jakobsen won the bunch sprint. And then Gilbert won yesterday, I think. We're on a good way.
But Gilbert gets all the credit, of course, but how much does Tim de Klerk deserve? Because he did an incredible job yesterday.
Yeah, he was the key of the victory, I think. What he did in the final close again for 40 seconds on two big favourites was an amazing job.
Well, that was Wilfried Peters on James Knox and on Philippe Gilbert and Tim de Klerk as well, his contribution to Gilbert's victory in Bilbao. And let's hear from James Knox himself, who rode extremely well today. We'll hear first from James and then from Nick Schultz.
Stage 13 done. Last Machuchos. What a climb that was. Tough day, making a quick getaway in the car now to the hotel. But big move went on the first main climb of the day. I was trying to be smart, surfing near the front. Watched 8 guys go, thought nothing to worry about here. Another 8 guys went, thought, don't really need to worry about that. And then another 10 guys jumped across, how many it was, and suddenly I was panicking a little bit, but in the end we got Gilbert in there. Still probably should have got myself in there, to be honest. In the end, resurrected things a little bit by fighting with the GC guys. Astana took it on with 2 or 3 climbs to go. Got some big, big motors to do that. Izaguirre, Cataldo, Luis Leon, it was really difficult, and they were going full down the descents as well, so it was just all in one line from maybe 50k to go, 40k to go. Not much fun at all, but regrouped, hung in, and then we just exploded onto Las Machuchos. The way they set off on these climbs, I really can't deal with. But kept fighting, made my own pace, managed to hang in there with like the second group of guys, and then actually eventually started picking them off one by one. And I think even with 2 or 3 guys out for still away from the breakaway, finished 13th on the day. So yeah, really good day in terms of the end product. Still maybe some extra tactical noose could be in there, but happy to see where, you know, I'm still fighting, still hanging tough. I think the one thing I'll need to tell you about today is grinding away up this climb. All the fans, we had the TV motorbike trying to come through the second group of the GC riders, and this motorbike was in first gear, revving out so much that the clutch went, and we were just riding in like a cloud of smoke. There was like only 10 guys from the GC group ahead, and then maybe 10 guys left behind, and we're just riding into these exhaust fumes for a good 500 meters. What's that all about? What a horrible climb. Really, really just on the limit, just crazy gradients. If the clutch is burning out, not sure it's an acceptable climb, but got up there in the end. And Canterbury is pretty lovely. Looks a bit like home actually, starting the climb. We had some dry stone walls, some farms, smell some cow pat on the, you know, muck spreading, green rolling hills, pretty beautiful actually. Some limestone and escarpments. Right at home, even steep like roads at home, a bit like the Yorkshire Dales actually, if I was gonna say where it was like in the UK, but sort of happy that one's out the way. Obviously full of morale now, you know, day by day seem to be holding my own, so this is, it's all going better than expected now. Everything from here on in's in a bonus. If I blow up before the end of the race, it's not a disaster, you know, it's all still learning. But looking forward, tomorrow's hopefully going to be a sprint day for us. Fabio looked amazingly good today, actually. He hung in there really well. Came up to me with like 60k to go, gave me a bottle of some gels, looking fresh as a daisy. So really good signs. And we'll be getting behind him for tomorrow. and hoping for a going for another stage win anyway, so fingers crossed for that, but get my feet up now, take it easy for another night. Ciao.
Stage 13, another tough one. Again, a big battle for the breakaway. I think that's going to be a regular occurrence every day from here until Madrid. It took 35k or so to go today, and it was a big, big group. I think 30 guys or so, and we put two riders in there with Scabu and Damo, which was really good and just kept things relaxed for us back in the peloton. Jumbo started riding pretty quickly, but just kept things pretty controlled and rode a good tempo for most of the day until Astana took over the reins and really ripped it with around 40k to go. From there, the peloton really whittled down and we just rallied around Esteban and Mikel, with a few of us riding there into the final climb with them before letting them do their thing. Unfortunately, Esteban had a mechanical problem on the final climb. In that scenario, on such a small, steep road, the cars were a bit blocked and it was unable to get to him very quickly. So, he had to limit losses, and credit to him. I don't know how he stays so positive and just keeps chipping away. It's really, really nice to be a part of and to see, and just sort of keeps everything in perspective, which is really good. Tomorrow, a lot flatter day, in saying that we are on the west coast of Spain, doing a lot of the coast roads, which is very, very undulating, and it will I'm sure be another big battle for the breakaway, unless of course we see that Quickstep and Bora have interest pretty quickly to control things for a potential sprint, but that's all a mystery for now. Otherwise today, not too much to report on. Nothing much really happened aside from chewing stem today. But yeah, it was probably one of the hardest, if not the hardest days so far in the Vuelta. And many, many hard days to come.
So in my fatigue state, I completely forgot to describe to you what it was like to ride the final climb. It's an absolutely brutal climb. I'd done it once before in the first Vuelta I did in 2017. But, you know, the mind has that power of actually blocking out the things that give you a lot of pain. So I couldn't quite remember it. And it certainly was harder than I remembered, or steeper, particularly the start. It was really, really just a wall at the start. So at that point, for the first K or so of the climb, I was with the GC group, just hanging on to sort of see Esteban and Mikel through that first part for as long as I could. And it was actually quite incredible, the speed that Astana were pulling at, which probably helped sort of mask the steep gradients a little bit, because once I had popped and went as easy as possible up the climb as I could, that's when things really became noticeable in terms of the gradient. So the first few K is on a normal bitumen road. It's very inconsistent. Every now and then you'll hit a pinch of 20% or 25% or something like that, and then there'll be a little bit of respite, maybe even a bit of a downhill to sort of give you a bit of a ramp, if you like, into the next steep section. So it's a very hard climb to be able to cruise up once the job's done, but nonetheless I did my best to go as easy as possible. The gearing I used today was a 36 inner chainring and a 30 as the biggest cog on the cassette, and that was still far too big for these type of gradients. It would have been nice to have a triple front derailleur, like on a mountain bike in the old school days, where you have something like a 25 inside chainring or something like that. That would have been ideal. After that, the last few Ks become almost like a boat ramp on the hairpins. They're like these slotted concrete slabs, almost identical to a boat ramp, I guess, to give traction to cars and bikes alike, to get up there. One beauty of riding up there solo is that you can just approach it as you like. You can get a little bit of speed before those steeper sections and then go really easy on the steep section, and then again gassing it before the next one. Every now and then people try to give a bit of a push, which is actually quite nice. Just a little pat on the back at 25% certainly makes things easier for a split second. And at that point in the race, it's not really having any impact on anyone, and it's not getting in the way. It's just pretty fun, and the fans just really get into it and sort of, yeah, bring a bit of a smile to everyone's face who's just battling their way up there. But yeah, that's a bit of insight into the climb. Sorry that I completely forgot to go through that.
Well, another fine installment of the audio diaries from James Knox and Nick Schultz. Thanks very much to the pair of you. I managed to get Nick's mug to him this morning, Stacey Snyder's mug. I gave James his the other day, and they seem delighted with those. They will go back on sale soon. I'm not exactly sure when, but certainly while the Vuelta is still on, raising money for two good causes, Andy's Man Club and the Bike Project. So, well, details about when they go on sale will be revealed soon. Daniel, I must ask you before we go tonight, what did you make of Pierre Latour's footballing performance at the start this morning? Did you not see it?
No.
Okay, so you know they started in the stadium.
Athletic Bilbao, yeah.
Yeah, they started in the stadium and rode across the grass.
Yeah,
it was
a
very, very odd.
It was.
I mean, because the seats were empty. So what was the purpose of that?
It's a good question.
It was really strange. They rode across the grass, but Pierre Latour, and I'm pretty sure it was Pierre Latour, I'm sure it was, and Shane Archbold set up a kind of football penalty. Pierre Latour using his helmet, he didn't actually kick it, but he placed his helmet on the penalty spot. Shane Archbold went in goal, and Latour did a big elaborate kind of pretend penalty. Didn't actually strike the helmet, so we can't really judge it.
Butt-clenchingly awful.
I thought if you had been watching, you'd have been
disgusted
judging it for, you know, sort of artistic merit. Because I know you're interested in cyclists when they become footballers, how bad they often are.
They're generally awful, aren't they? I've still not managed to erase the memory of that video that Team Sky put out of a few of their players at.
There was Bora Hansgrohe, wasn't there, as well?
Hansgrohe was bad.
Yeah.
The only one I've seen who's sort of saved any kind of dignity has been Chris Lawless. Had quite a nice left foot. Quite a sweet left foot.
That's earned him another 2 years at Team Ineos.
I didn't read the press release, but I'm sure it mentioned his sweet left foot. I was thinking about the Athletic Bilbao, the stage that started today outside the San Mamés Stadium. And of course, Athletic Bilbao is famous for its recruitment policy, or the fact that only Basque, either born or sort of footballistically raised players can play for Athletic Bilbao in almost exactly the same fashion as Euskadi, the former Basque team, the almost sort of de facto Basque national cycling team. They had the same policy, really, didn't they? But I was wondering about the Euskadi Murias team, and I feel quite embarrassed that I don't know this, whether they don't have a policy, do they?
I'm not sure, but I assume that they're all Basque, but maybe that's a false assumption. Not sure either whether they're going to carry on next year. We did cover that a little bit in the Com to Zero, that team. There's the speculation about their future. But there's also Mikel Landa's Euskadi Foundation team, which is, you know, stepping up a little bit.
Stop press, Rich. They do not have that policy because Hector Saez, who was in the break today, off the front on his own for a long time, looked as though he might have a decent chance, is from Albacete in the south-east of Spain. So that's just one rider. I imagine there are probably more who are not from the Basque Country.
One of the interesting things about Euskadi and that policy was that just the depth of talent in the Basque Country is extraordinary, and there are really good riders from the Basque Country who never rode for Euskaltel Euskadi, including Juanma Garate, who is in our Kilometre Zero episode, who, you know, is a good rider but never rode for Euskaltel Euskadi.
I say that about size, Rich, but he could also have been schooled as a cyclist in the Basque Country.
As a lot were, yeah. Daniel, one thing that didn't make it into the episode about the Basque Country was a little chat that I had with Eneko about the Basque language. And it is the language that's taught in schools in the Basque Country. Spanish is taught almost as a foreign language. Kids do pick it up, so they're all kind of bilingual, but Basque is a really thriving language, and it's a young person's language because it was only taught in schools after the end of the Franco dictatorship. It was introduced.
Also often referred to as the hardest language in the world to learn.
Well, I was going to ask if you have any competence in Basque
zero,
at all.
Zero. It's a language that's completely flummoxed linguists for a long time. There are some linguists that have posited links with Finnish, with Hungarian even, but very, very difficult. I mean, have you heard any over the last couple of days? The Vuelta is very good, actually. When we go to regions with their own language, which in Spain is relatively common, they do have a policy of, on the stage in the morning, a sign-on podium. They do some of the announcements in the sort of regional language or the local language. So I was listening to it in Bilbao a couple of days ago, and there is the odd word that sounds like Spanish or has something in common with Spanish, but it can sound
lots of X's.
Very, very different.
Lots of X's in Basque. But yeah, I mean, and in France as well, it was actually banned in the classroom until 1981. So I don't think in the French part of the Basque Country, it's certainly not taught as a first language there. So I'm not sure how popular it is there, but in the Spanish part of the Basque Country, it is the first language, and kids going to school, that's the language they learn, which is fascinating. Anyway, we should leave it there, Daniel. Before we go, the Tour of Britain starts tomorrow, I think, and it starts without Richard Carapaz, who wasn't able to get a visa to travel to the UK, which is interesting, given that he's joining Team Ineos as well next year. But it's starting, and Conor Dunn is going to be keeping an audio diary for friends of the Cycling Podcast, so please sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com if you want to hear that and lots of other exclusive episodes, but I'm sure that'll be really good. He was supposed to do it last year, but obviously didn't end up riding. We must say thanks to some friends of the podcast tonight. It is the turn of Jeffrey Cross, Mark Spiller, Alan Thompson, Martini Colasar, Paul Banks, and Andrew Babayan. I got accused the other night of murdering someone's surname. I suspect I've just done that there. But anyway, apologies, Andrew.
Daniel Wainwright, Travis Burge, Peter Singlehurst, Tim Van Delft, Martin Howe, Daniel Chaffer, Tade Poglic, and Primoz Rogacar.
Thanks, Daniel.